I'm Alan McGaffin.
This is May 30th, 2021, Sunday, and we're here to read the Sioux City Journal for our listeners through the Iowa Reading Information Service.
Looking at the front page here on this Sunday, we've had a cloudy and rainy day. We're getting some showers this morning. The forecast is for a high of 61 degrees, a little warmer today. Cloudy and cooler with rain ending toward this afternoon and this evening. A low of 48 tonight. Tomorrow, warmer yet and sunny. 74 for a high Monday, 74 Tuesday, and 80 degrees on Wednesday. The sunshine comes back, stays with us most of this week. Thursday is forecast for 84 degrees. Front page stories, we have a story, several stories about visits, travel, tourism, and we have a story that Terry will read to us about some court decisions in the state of Iowa.
Certainly. Well, this story comes from Aaron Murphy and Mike Brownlee, and they are the Journal's Des Moines Bureau and the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. The future of abortion services in Iowa is uncertain, with a potential amendment to the state constitution and a looming key case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Those pending outcomes have the potential to dramatically impact to what extent abortion remains legal in Iowa and around the country. And those monumental cases come as access to abortion has become rare in Iowa, even as the number of abortions here has increased. It's very clear across the country, reproductive freedom is under attack, said Jamie Birch Elliott, director of public affairs at Planned Parenthood Advocates of Iowa. Abortion access is being limited. Only 9 medical facilities in Iowa provided abortions in 2017, and that was a 33% decline from 3 years earlier, and 93% of Iowa counties had no such facility, according to a recent study from the Guttmacher Institute, a nonprofit research and policy organization that advocates for sexual and reproductive health and rights. More than half of Iowa's women lived in the counties with no medical facility that provided abortions, the institute said. And yet, the number of abortions in Iowa increased 24% in 2019, the most recent year for which state public health data is available, a jump that critics attribute to the state's decision to withdraw from a federally funded family planning program. There were 3,542 abortions provided in Iowa in 2019, according to state public health data. Of those, roughly 2/3 were medically induced and roughly 1/3 were surgically induced, according to the state data. Those numbers could be dramatically impacted pending the outcome of Republican state lawmakers' attempt to amend Iowa's constitution and the U.S. Supreme Court ruling. During the recently concluded session of the Iowa legislature, Republicans approved a proposal that began the process of amending the Iowa Constitution to state the document does not guarantee the right to an abortion. The proposed constitutional amendment is in response to recent state court decisions that have struck down legislation restricting access to abortions, including proposals that would have required a 3-day waiting period before an abortion and banned abortions after the fetus heartbeat can be detected. Republicans' plan is that if the state constitution states it does not guarantee the right to an abortion, future legislative attempts to restrict abortions will have a better chance of surviving legal challenges. The Iowa legislature must pass the proposed amendment again after an election, so in 2023 at the earliest. If the legislature passes the proposed amendment a second time, it will go to a public vote, likely in 2024. Meantime, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a challenge to a Louisiana law that requires doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. The case is viewed as a trial balloon to determine how willing the conservative-leaning Supreme Court may be to give the legal okay to state laws that restrict access to abortions. Mary Smith, with Gabriel's Corner in Council Bluffs, a pro-life Christian ministry that works with women and men facing an unplanned pregnancy welcomed the Supreme Court's decision to hear the case and said the ministry hopes the case will lead to an eventual overturning of Roe v. Wade, the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case that preserved women's right to an abortion. "We pray daily for an end to abortion," Smith said. Gabriel's Corner works with women and men to choose life for their babies by either accepting their role as a parent or giving their baby up for adoption, according to its website. Smith said Gabriel's Corner offers free services to area mothers and fathers, including ultrasounds, counseling, and monetary assistance. She said the organization has helped more than 10,000 abortion-vulnerable women since its founding 15 years ago. "People are on hard times. They make poor choices. We work to help them through it," Smith said. Birch Elliott said the pending U.S. Supreme Court ruling and proposed amendment to the Iowa Constitution could lead to the end of legal abortion in Iowa. "There's no doubt in my mind we could be looking at abortion being illegal in Iowa in the near future," Elliott said. "Iowans support safe access to abortion. It should remain legal in the state." Fewer than one-third of Iowans support the proposed constitutional amendment, while a 58% majority opposes it, according to a Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll published in March. More generally, a 52% majority of Iowans believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases, according to Pew Research Center polling, while 46% of Iowans believe abortion should be illegal in all or most cases.
Okay. Back to the front page here, a story by Dolly Butts. Upswing in visitors. Last summer, Sioux City's tourism industry suffered a blow as events were postponed and canceled due to the COVID pandemic, and local attractions were shuttered to visitors in an effort to curb the spread of the virus. Heading into Memorial Day weekend, the traditional start of the summer vacation tour season, Mark Baltusius, president of the Greater Siouxland Hospitality Association, was optimistic on tourism prospects for this year. Quote, "Occupancy's not a pre-pandemic levels yet. However, the market, we've seen a substantial increase in occupancy compared to this time last year. Hotels are expecting a busy summer. Events are going on around town. Stuff at United Sports Academy and the arena, different sports aspects, the Battery Park concert series, construction projects here in town. Everything seems to be looking very promising for the summer." And Shirley Phillips, executive director of the Western Iowa Tourism Region, said the state's tourism industry is a $9.2 billion industry, generating $540 million in tax revenue for the state. When everything was shut down last year, that revenue was lost. Well, the story goes on to talk about the importance of tourism in several different places, including the Great Lakes, the Okoboji region, and Western Iowa in particular. Bruce Miller also writes about tourism and the upcoming summer vacation ideas for all of us that are close around the region. But he also mentions that next month there will be a longer series of details about 100 places to go close to us here in Siouxland. So we can expect to hear more about that in coming weeks for the summer.
Yes, and we look forward to a summer when we all can get out and travel more, visit with friends and family.
Well, turn to page two.
Oh, go ahead.
Turning to page two of the front section here, a story from the Associated Press. 100 years later, the black fears in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with the police department still very much lingering fear. There's been an undeniable progress in the relationship between the Tulsa police and the city's black community in the past 100 years. And then again, it's hard to imagine it could have gotten any worse. Complaints about police bias, lack of enough minority officers, all still remain. The police chief is now a black man from North Tulsa, Oklahoma. The area includes what once was America's wealthiest black business district. Back in 1921, decades before there was an American civil rights movement, even the thought of a black police officer would have been inconceivable. That year, Greenwood, the black North Tulsa neighborhood that includes the area known as Black Wall Street, was burned to the ground with the assistance of virtually an all-white Tulsa Police Department. That was sparked by accusations that a 19-year-old black man had assaulted a 17-year-old white girl in a Tulsa elevator. It led to a massacre, with 300 black people dead, thousands of black Tulsa residents displaced. 35 square blocks were torched, and damages spiraled into the millions. Tulsa's police department deputized white mobs and provided them with guns. Numerous reports describing white men with badges setting fire and shooting black people as part of that invasion. According to the Associated Press article from that time, black people who were driven from their homes by the hundreds all shouted, "Don't shoot," as they rushed through the flames. After the massacre went largely ignored for decades, awareness has increased in recent years. Police Chief Chuck Jordan stood in Greenwood back in 2013 and apologized for the police department's role. Quote, "I can't apologize for the actions, inaction, and derelictions of those individual officers and their chief," Mr. Jordan said. "But as your chief today, I apologize for our police department. I'm sorry and distressed the Tulsa Police Department did not protect its citizens in those tragic days of 1921. The appointment of Wendell Franklin succeeding Jordan last year is seen by some as a measure of progress, but black Tulsa folks say that's not enough. I think it's something the community needs to see," says Ina Mitchell, a 70-year-old woman who was raised in North Tulsa. But how far does that change really go when the doors are closed? In a 2018 Gallup Tulsa City Voice Index poll designed to measure quality of life issues, only 18% of black Tulsa residents say they trust the police a lot, compared to 49% of white residents. And 46% of black Tulsans say they trust the police department not at all, or not much, compared to only 16% of whites that were asked that trust question.
Okay, next to that story about Tulsa, on page 8-2, we also have a story titled "Racism, Discrimination Permeate U.S. Military." For Stephanie Davis, who grew up with little, the military was a path to the American dream, a realm where everyone would receive equal treatment. She joined the Air Force in 1988 and steadily advanced over the course of decades, becoming a flight surgeon, commander of flight medicine at Fairchild Air Force Base, and eventually a lieutenant colonel. But many of her service colleagues, Davis says, viewed her only as a black woman, or for the white resident colleagues who gave her the call sign of ABW, it was a joke. They insisted an angry black woman, a classic racist trope. White subordinates often refused to salute her, and she was attacked with racial slurs, she said. For blacks and minorities, when we initially experience racism or discrimination in the military, we feel blindsided, Davis said. We are taught to believe that it's the one place where everybody has a level playing field, and that we can make it to the top with work that's based on merit. In interviews with the Associated Press, current and former enlistees and officers in nearly every branch of the armed services described a deep-rooted culture of racism and discrimination that stubbornly festers despite repeated efforts to eradicate it. The Associated Press found that the military's judicial system has no explicit category for hate crimes, making it difficult to quantify crimes motivated by prejudice. The Defense Department also has no way to track the number of troops ousted for extremist views, despite its repeated pledge to root them out. More than 20 people linked to the January 6th siege of the U.S. Capitol were found to have military ties. The Associated Press also found that the Uniform Code of Military Justice does not adequately address discriminatory incidents, and that rank-and-file people of color commonly face courts-martials panels made up of all-white service members, which some experts argue can lead to harsher outcomes. The military said It processed more than 750 complaints of discrimination by race or ethnicity from service members in the fiscal year 2020 alone. But discrimination doesn't exist just within the military rank and file. That same fiscal year, civilians working in the financial, technical, and support sectors of the Army, Air Force, and Navy also filed 900 complaints of racial discrimination and over 350 complaints of discrimination by skin color, data from the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission shows. In February, Lloyd J. Austin III, a former Army general who now is Secretary of Defense, the first black man to serve in the post, ordered commanders and supervisors to take an operational pause for one day to discuss extremism in the ranks with their service members. The Southern Poverty Law Center sent Austin a letter shortly after his order, applauding him for his decisive action, but underscoring that systemic change on all military levels is urgent. Those who are indoctrinated into white supremacist ideology present a significant threat to national security and the safety of our communities, SPLC President Margaret Huang wrote. In a statement to the Associated Press, the Defense Department said, extremism is not widespread in the armed forces, but acknowledged that efforts to stamp out extremist views from the rank and file have historically been reactive versus proactive until recently. Pentagon spokesman Major Cesar Santiago pointed to Austin's stand-down order in February that stressed the oath of office taken by military personnel, including a commitment to protecting our nation from enemies foreign and domestic. Austin pledged to rid the ranks of racists and extremists during his confirmation hearing before Congress, which came on the heels of the Capitol insurrection. The job of the Department of Defense is to keep America safe from our enemies, he said, but we can't do that if some of those enemies lie within our own ranks. At the end of 2020, the Defense Department released a report aimed at identifying ways to improve racial and ethnic diversity in the U.S. military. Among the findings, the enlisted ranks of the active and reserve military were slightly more racially and ethnically diverse than its U.S. civilian counterparts, but not the officer corps.
Go.
All right, on page A5 of the Sioux City Journal this morning, May 30th, 2021, there are some photographs and a mention of the fact that the three public high schools in Sioux City had their graduation ceremonies yesterday at the Tyson Event Center, North High School, West High School, and East High School.
Well, about 18 minutes into the broadcast this morning, and I'll turn to the National and the World page. First up, White House asks the court to dismiss the suit. From Tallahassee, Florida, the Biden administration's urging a federal court to dismiss a lawsuit that could stand in the way of states like Florida allowing prescription drugs to be imported from Canada. It's a legal brief Friday that was filed, the White House arguing that the lawsuit on behalf of U.S. pharmaceutical companies was premature because the federal government has yet to approve any important programs of importing drugs. The administration's legal filing came on the same day Florida's Republican governor, who's considering a run for the White House in 4 years, or 3 years, called on the Biden administration to approve its drug import application. Florida and New Mexico are the only two states that so far formally have asked the U.S. government to allow federally approved drugs to be imported from Canada. Both states argue that doing so would save Americans millions of dollars in drug costs. Another news brief, this one from the Philippines. The Philippines has demanded that China withdraw its ships and fishing vessels from the vicinity of a Philippine-occupied island in the South China Sea. The Chinese military asserts its sovereignty, and it vows unswervingly to safeguard the disputed territory. In the exchange of protests by the Asian neighbors, internationally called over this island that's called Thitu, internationally by that name, is the largest flare-up in a long-simmering territory feud in the strategic waterway, which has escalated in the last few months. Department of Foreign Affairs in Manila said yesterday it's filed a diplomatic protest against, quote, the incessant deployment, the prolonged presence, and the illegal activities of Chinese maritime assets and fishing vessels in the vicinity of the islands. It used the Philippine name Thitu, while China calls the island Zongyi Dao. Other news briefs include Texas Republicans digging in yesterday for their final weekend votes on some of the most restrictive new voting laws in the United States. They're putting their last touches on a sweeping bill that would eliminate drive-through voting, it would empower partisan poll watchers, and it would limit voting on Sundays, when many black churchgoers have headed to the polls in Texas and other states for the last several years. A news brief from Afghanistan, a roadside bomb struck a minivan full of university lecturers and students yesterday in the northern province of Kapisa, killed at least four, wounding others. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the attack. News from the Suez Canal, an Egyptian court yesterday adjourned a case of a hulking cargo vessel that blocked the Suez, as we recall earlier this year. The move is to allow more time for negotiators aiming to resolve the financial dispute between the canal authority and the owner of the ship. A 19-year-old daughter of Moneyball writer Michael Lewis and former MTV correspondent Tabitha Soren died in Northern California yesterday in a highway crash. Dixie Lewis was a passenger in the car driven by her friend Ross Schultz, who also died in the Tuesday accident, according to authorities. From outer space, a news brief, a rocket carrying fuel and supplies for China's new space station blasted off yesterday from the South China Sea. The Chinese Space Agency says 11 space launches are planned through the end of next year, delivering two more modules for this 70-ton space station to supply a three-member crew.
All right, and finally, from page A9 of the front section, another story. And I don't think this will be really news for our listeners, so I'll just briefly mentioned that we are seeing that more states are easing rules. And we start with Providence, Rhode Island, just in time for Memorial Day weekend. More U.S. cities and states are shrugging off lingering COVID-19 restrictions as vaccination rates rise and the number of infections falls. So Massachusetts lifted a mask requirement Saturday, a day after New Jersey dropped its mandate. In New York City and Chicago, officials reopened public beaches, though winds and cool temperatures kept crowds away. Welcome back, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot said in a video announcement. The lakefront is open. And we know that here in Iowa and in the tri-state area, those rules are also easing and more people are welcomed to go out and about without masks if they have been vaccinated. All right, turning to the opinion page in this morning's Sioux City Journal, the journal's editorial board wants to remind us why we must remember why we began observing Memorial Day. And so as we celebrate this Memorial Day weekend amid all the backyard barbecues, camping trips, boat excursions, and three-day weekend getaways, it's easy to lose sight of the origins of Memorial Day. 153 years ago today, northern U.S. states observed the first Decoration Day. General John A. Logan, the leader of a group of Union Civil War veterans, was credited with creating a National Day of Remembrance in which flowers and other decorations were strewn on the graves of comrades who died in defense of their country during the late rebellion and whose bodies now lie in almost every city, village, and hamlet churchyard in the land. And that's what General John Logan is credited with saying in starting Memorial Day weekend. So I'm going to turn now to the letters to the editor. And the first letter is from Rhonda Hates of Council Bluffs. And her last name is spelled H-A-I-T-Z. And Rhonda writes, I'm forever tied to Nebraska. My entire extended family is from Northeast Nebraska. My parents still live there. I went to college at Wayne State. My husband and I have both worked and paid income taxes in Nebraska for 12 years. But our daughter can't live in Nebraska. She has Down syndrome, which means she needs extensive medical services and therapeutic interventions. If we moved to Nebraska, she would lose access to Medicaid and her home and community-based services while she sat on the developmental disabilities wait list for 7 to 10 years. Being able to access Medicaid means we don't have to choose between speech therapy, occupational therapy, and physical therapy. Can you imagine having to ration care and make the choice between your child learning to talk or walk? The Family Support Waiver, LB 376, would have provided another tool to address the 7 to 10 year wait list for individuals with developmental disabilities in Nebraska. Families would have had access to Medicaid and a small budget to pay for respite, specialized child care, and home and vehicle modifications necessary for their children. But the Nebraska unicameral killed the bill this month. Families were referred to as millionaires taking advantage of the state. Not true. They are parents who are trying to provide for their children and hoping it doesn't cost them their homes, marriages, and ability to work, or cause them to flee to another state that provides better access to services. I guess the state motto is right. Nebraska, it's not for everyone. The second letter comes from Jim Carlin of Sioux City, and Jim writes, I shook my head in disbelief as I read a recent Los Angeles Times story that appeared in the Sioux City Journal titled, Migrant Families Separated by Trump Get Therapy. I asked myself, how many times can one man be blamed for the repercussions of other people's choices? The therapists who treated the migrant families came to the conclusion that the zero-tolerance border policy of Trump inflicted severe psychological harm. What about the oppression of the migrants endured in their homeland? What about hauling their children across the desert, or worse, sending their children to the border with paid escorts or no escorts at all? What about the activist groups that encourage the border surge, or the cartels that exploit the situation for profit? Didn't any of these decisions create trauma? True professional mental health counseling should lead the patient to recovery, not blame. Recovery always includes accountability. Let the readers beware of any media coverage that ignores the facts behind the border crisis and sacrifices truth for political blame games, from Jim Carlin.
I'll turn to E.J. Dionne this morning on the opinion page. President Biden and his party are facing their first big moment of truth. How much can they get done? Doesn't matter if they get Republican support along the way. The second question irritates a lot of Democrats, since it's clear that some of their most important objectives, especially guaranteeing the right to vote, will never win enough Republican votes to overcome a Senate filibuster. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer plans to test Republicans by bringing it up as early as Thursday this week, a House bill that would create a bipartisan commission to investigate that January 6th insurrection on the Capitol. Even Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kristen Sinema of Arizona, the most outspoken Democrat defenders of the filibuster, are impatient with their GOP colleagues and its opposition to the inquiry. If Republicans kill that inquiry, they will only hasten filibuster reform. Equally consequential are ongoing negotiations over Biden's infrastructure proposal. A group of moderate conservatives led by Shelley Moore Capito, a Republican from West Virginia, have been in discussions with Biden over whether parts of his plan might be passed with some Republican votes. Biden's lopped $500 billion off the $2.2 trillion proposal, but the GOP senators say that's not enough. They continue to oppose Biden's tax increases on corporations and the wealthy. Last month, reflecting a view inside the White House, Senator Chris Coons, Democrat from Delaware, set a Memorial Day deadline for establishing whether a bipartisan deal could even be achieved. There are glimmerings of a possibility. A Democratic aide close to the negotiations expressed guarded optimism Wednesday that a deal running close to $1 trillion, with about $600 billion in new spending, could be reached early next month. The theory is that the more money that's approved on a bipartisan basis, the smaller a second Democrat-only bill covering many of Biden's remaining priorities, including some of his tax proposals, would have to be, making it easier sell the Democrat moderates like Manchin. Promised deals can evaporate, of course, but the discussion raises a larger question. Are voters primarily interested in a better process or better outcomes? A study set to be released Thursday by the Center for American Progress, a center-left think tank, suggests that citizens are frustrated with political acrimony, that a substantial majority want government active in producing a better economy, so outcomes. Based on a poll conducted by CAP and GBAO Strategies, the report concludes, Americans desperately want less fighting in politics and more cooperation. That's why Biden calls for unity, and those go over well with people. So do his actual achievements. His $1.9 trillion rescue bill passed last March without a single Republican vote, wins an endorsement of 66 of all Americans. Even 41% of Republicans like that bill. Bipartisan longings confront deep differences between the parties right down to their grassroots. For the Democrats, the study finds the top two issue priorities are controlling the pandemic and increasing access to health care. For Republicans, the priorities are limiting immigration and securing the borders, by far the most important priorities for the Republicans, followed by reducing government spending. And you still wonder why they fight? Still, one priority matters to both sides, and that is creating jobs and improving wages. On this core aspiration, the country's philosophically inclined to share the Democrats' view on how to make it happen. 58% of voters agree with the statement, quote, "The government should help drive public and private investments into the sources of good jobs such as tech, infrastructure, healthcare, higher education, and domestic manufacturing." Only 35% picked the Reagan-era alternative, which is, quote, "The government should stay out of the economy and allow the private sector and open markets to determine what to invest in and where to allocate the resources," quote. When offering respondents a list of 20 priorities, the CAP pollsters found that spend less time fighting on social media and in politics ranked number two. And what was number one? Quote, "We need to clean up all levels of government to make sure politicians are paying attention to the needs of American voters and not just corporations, campaign donors, and the wealthiest few." So the upshot of this, Mr. Dionne writes, walking away from political reform, even if Republicans oppose it, would be foolish for Democrats. John Halpin, a CAP senior fellow and principal author of the report, tells me that while Biden is wise in light of his promises to try to find common ground with at least some people on the other side, he'd be better off not to focus on elite bipartisanship, but to promote consensus ideas for national economic renewal. So yeah, Democrats, visibly trying to reduce the level of rancor in politics was an upside, but not at the cost of throwing your core commitments overboard.
All right, we'll turn now to the obituaries in the Sioux City Journal on today, Sunday, May the 30th of 2021. First obituary is for Verna Joy Weston Smith. She was 78. She died Saturday, July 4th of last year. The services will be June 12th at 10:30 a.m. at St. James United Methodist Church in Sioux City. Next is Barbara J. O'Sell, formerly of Sioux City. She peacefully passed away with her family by her side on Tuesday, May 11th, at the age of 86. A celebration of Barb's life will take place from 5 to 7 on June 11th at Oscar Carl Vineyard, 1473 Buchanan Avenue in Sioux City. Memorial donations may be made in Barb's name to the Alzheimer's Association at cure.act.alz.org or Cure Alzheimer's Funding at curealz.org.
Next from Sioux City, Maxine Grubel. Maxine Grubel, 89, died Friday, May 28th. Service is scheduled for June 2nd, 10:30, Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Burial in Graceland Cemetery. Visitation planned for 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. Next from Lamar's, Arden Blake. Mr. Blake passed away Thursday, May 27th. Service is scheduled for the 1st of June, 7 p.m., Fish Funeral Home and Monument in Remsen. Visitation also for June 1st, 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Sioux City for Christy L. Barbie, B-A-R-B-E-E, Barbie. Christy was 63 and passed away Thursday, May 27th. Service is scheduled June the 3rd, 11 a.m., Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel with burial in Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation June the 3rd, 9 to 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Sioux City for Carlton Thomas Grindberg. Carl Grindberg, 91, passed away Thursday, May 27th. Service is June the 5th, 1 p.m., Morningside Lutheran Church, burial in Graceland Park Cemetery. Visitation June 5th, 12 to 1 p.m. at the church. Arrangements with Christy Smith Funeral Home, Morningside Chapel.
All right, and then there's Harvey H. Stokes, Jr. He was 79 of Sioux City. He died Monday, October 26th of 2020, and he due to a long battle with cancer. Services will be 10 a.m. on Saturday at Faith United Presbyterian Church with Pastor David Kaler officiating. A luncheon will follow. Christy Smith Funeral Home, Morningside Chapel, is assisting the family with arrangements. Memorials may be directed to Faith United Presbyterian Church. We'll turn next to Lucille Minnie Kepe, K-O-E-P-P-E, of Guthrie Center. She was 86, formerly of Allen, Nebraska, and Lawton, Iowa, and she died May 24th at Thomas Rest Haven in Coon Rapids. Services will be at 6 p.m. on Monday at the First United Methodist Church in Guthrie Center. Visitation from 4 to 6 p.m. that same day. Burial will be at 12 p.m. on Tuesday at Memorial Park in Sioux City. And then Mardell L. Koppel, she was 90, of Homer, passed away this Thursday, May 27th, at her home surrounded by family. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Homer. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday at Moran Becker Hunt Funeral Home. Burial will be at Omaha Valley Cemetery in rural Homer. Online condolences may be directed to MeyerBrothersChapel.com. Go.
Mary Louise Galloway, 97, formerly of Sioux City, passed away May the 27th in Newton, Iowa. I'll move next to Betty Garner of Sioux City. Betty, nicknamed Betty Boop, passed away at age 76 on Monday, November 30th, 2020, in a Waterloo hospital due to COVID. Services will be 10:30 this Friday at Christy Smith Funeral Homes of Morningside Chapel. Next is Kathleen Ann Deers Spore. Kathleen Spore from Sloan, Iowa, passed away at age 55 on March the 9th. Service is scheduled for June the 5th, 11 a.m., St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Visitation June the 4th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the church, and arrangements with Waterbury Funeral Services of Sergeant Bluff. Next from Cherokee, formerly of Onawa, Warren Moon. Mr. Moon, 84, passed away Wednesday, December 30th. Graveside services for June the 2nd, 3 p.m. at Onawa Cemetery in Onawa. Arrangements with Boothby Funeral Homes of Cherokee. Formerly Sioux City, Sarah Ellen Verstegen, she passed away at Brentwood Bay, British Columbia on April 21st. Two memorials have already been heralded for Sarah Ellen Versteegan. Next, from Johnston, Iowa, Callie Rose Lisa Derflinger, previously Callie Christensen of Sioux City, graduate of West High School, probably a student for many years, great student at West High School. But Callie passed away last Wednesday, May 26th. Services will be held 11 a.m. on Friday at North Point Church, 9901 Northwest 62nd Avenue in Johnston, and visitation will be held 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway in West Des Moines. Online condolences may be left to the Hamilton's Funeral Home website for more details.
Next, we have Marie Pat Byrne. Marie T. Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E, nicknamed Pat. She was 90 years old and of Sioux City, and she passed away on Wednesday, May 26, at Holy Spirit Retirement Home. A mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday at Holy Cross Parish, Blessed Sacrament Church in Sioux City. Burial will follow at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. There will be a rosary at 4 p.m., and the family will greet friends from 6 to 8 p.m. with a 7 p.m. vigil service. Memorials in Pat's name may be directed to the Queen of Peace or Sioux City Carmelites. And then there is Orvin Hansen, Jr., nicknamed Jerry, and he lived in Mesa. He was formerly from Soldier, Iowa, and he was 78, and he died Wednesday, July 15th of 2020. The services will be June 5th at 10:30 a.m., Soldier Lutheran Church in Soldier, Iowa. Masks are required. There will be a celebration of life after the service, and the burial will be at the Soldier Lutheran Cemetery. Arrangements with Rush Family Care Service, Ottawa, Iowa. Evelyn J. Fleming of South Sioux City. She was 84, and she passed away Monday, May 24th, at home with family present. Service will be at 2 p.m. on Saturday at Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home in South Sioux City, and visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service time. Online condolences may be directed to MeyerBrothersChapels.com. Samuel C. Hollowell, he was 100 years old, of Hornick, Iowa, passed away Saturday, May 22nd, at his home with Carol by his side. Services will be held at 11 a.m. on Wednesday at the Hornick United Methodist Church with Pastor Katie Newman officiating. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. with prayer service at 7 p.m. on Tuesday at the church. And arrangements are under the direction of Waterbury Funeral Service.
Jerry Dick or Dyke Hicks. Mr. Hicks was 86 of Sioux City and passed away Sunday, December 20th at a local hospital from the COVID pandemic. Graveside services were on Christmas Eve of 2020, December 24th, at the Logan Park Cemetery. Celebration of his life will be 11 a.m. this coming Thursday at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel, and condolences can be sent to the Meyer Brothers website. The family wishes to give a big thanks to the ICU nurses at St. Luke's for their time and care. An enormous special thanks to Jerry's helpers and pit crew, Keith, Jack, Michael, Dave, Brad, Scott, Sean, Mike, Mark, Kevin, Ben, Mike, Lance, George T., and grandson David. And thank you, Josh, for keeping Jerry informed. Memorials may be sent to the Hospice of Siouxland, Sioux City Gospel Mission, or Racers Emergency Support Program, Inc., Post Office Box 485 in Gresham, Oregon, zip code 97030. Dad, you were one of a kind. We love you. And that concludes obituaries for this morning.
What we see in the obituaries today is that there are many individuals who have passed away in the last year during the COVID pandemic who are now being remembered, and celebration of life services are being held for many people. So on this Memorial Day weekend, We remember those we have loved and lost.
Well, the time is about 46 minutes into broadcast. I'll turn to a story in this morning's paper from Bloomberg News. President Biden's spending push is targeting racial and social inequities. Biden's $6 trillion budget request proposes record-shattering actions to reduce historical disparities in underserved communities, following his own campaign pledge to promote racial equity as an inseparable part of rebuilding our economy. In the 1,740-page proposal sent to Capitol Hill on Friday, President Biden attempts to make good on his promises on climate, infrastructure, education, and the social safety net. Across those areas was a particular attention to economic and social disparities among race and ethnic peoples. His emphasis was evident in nearly every line item of the infrastructure portion of the budget, as well as others. Highway construction programs would recognize an attempt to repair the way previous building road projects often divided minority communities in half. Clean water infrastructure would replace lead pipes that poison older neighborhoods. Research and development grants would have a set aside for historically black colleges and universities. And in other areas, White House officials say the focus is on equity, and it's built into the bills. We're looking at implementing all of our programs with that in mind, says Shalonda Young, Biden's acting budget director. This isn't something we should have to call out. This is something that should be pervasive in how the government does its business. The budget did not provide a breakout of programs designed specifically to address racial and ethnic disparities, so there's no accounting of the total spending. But a review of some of Biden's biggest proposals finds some examples. Example, a $400 billion expansion of Medicaid, which would allow for better pay and benefits for community-based and home health care workers who are disproportionately minority women. Point. Funding for the Indian Health Service would be increased by $2.2 billion. The plan proposes $200 billion to implement implicit bias training for healthcare workers and to address the disparity in care for rural and minority women. It proposes spending $3 billion on programs to reduce maternal mortality among non-white women. The most expensive item would establish new child care programs and pay for universal paid family leave. The definition of family would include non-traditional families, which include LGBTQ parents and people with disabilities. School lunch, summer nutrition programs would be expanded, and a maternal health initiative would try to reduce race disparities in deaths from childbirth. The president's plan would provide as many as 4 additional years of public education at the beginning and at the end of a person's schooling, starting with universal preschool and making community colleges and universities free. At $7 billion over 10 years, one of the smallest categories of spending is teacher training. Biden's plan would help recruit minority teachers and support teachers' colleges in minority communities. An emphasis on clean drinking water would eliminate lead water pipes that endanger the health of children in older minority neighborhoods like Flint, Michigan, a majority black city where thousands of children were exposed to lead-contaminated water. The $45 billion program would replace all of the nation's lead water lines. So a lot of spending there, but it's going to people, and social net, safety net programs.
All right, as we approach, we're at 50 minutes, almost 51 minutes into the broadcast. So we'd like to share a couple stories with you from the business page. And one is a Sioux City feature. Sioux City man finds success bottling a plant milk beverage called horchata. I think that's how it's pronounced. The story goes, it's by Mason Doctor, in a relatively short span of time this year, Bernabe Mendoza went from having little experience making horchata to struggling to keep up with the crazed demand for his bottled dairy beverage. Mendoza, 29, started selling his Love Chata brand horchata drink earlier this month. At present, there are two places selling it, Maria Supermarket at 2205 Dakota Avenue in South Sioux, and the Dagas on Wheels food truck, Dagas on Wheels. Customers seem to love Love Chata, which Mendoza prepares from scratch in the kitchen of Major's Sports Bar at 1012 4th Street. The bar doesn't really use the kitchen, so it's primarily used to prepare horchata. "Can't keep up with demand," Mendoza said. Horchata is a sweet drink composed of rice, milk, sugar, vanilla, and cinnamon. It's popular in Mexico and Central America, and in the United States as a part of the Latin American cuisine. Despite its popularity, horchata isn't often bottled and sold on the shelf the way other dairy treats are, and it isn't something most people make at home every day. "I think that's why the hype is so big," Mendoza said. Before he developed Love Chata, Mendoza had felt somewhat disappointed by the horchata he'd had at restaurants. Although neither he nor his family had a special recipe, he was convinced he could do it better. He had some experience in the world of food processing and distribution, having worked for several years at Wells Enterprises in Lamar's and at Empirical Foods in South Sioux City. "I was like, what if I just made my own?" Mendoza said. So he turned to the internet with its many horchata recopies or recipes and tutorials, videos. He spent 5 months finessing his recipe.
Recopies.
Whew. All right, my apologies to the listeners. I just stumbled over a typographical error in the newspaper. But Mr. Mendoza's horchata, again, can be purchased from Daga on Wheels or Maria's Supermarket on Dakota Avenue in South Sioux City. All right, Alan, and another brief story from the business section today.
Group presents construction awards to major local projects. And folks, these aren't projects that you're going to do in your own backyard. The Siouxland Construction Alliance presented awards to winners of their first ever Construction in Excellence Awards in a ceremony April 29th. A trio of major Sioux City projects received the awards. Two projects won projects, which the category projects above $5 million category. One of the winners was the Siouxland Expo Center. The other winner was the Warrior Hotel and the Davidson Building projects. The Interstate 29 Woodbury County Emergency Storm Sewer Repair along the Big Sioux River also won the under $1.5 million category. The awards were given based on points system with following criteria. The point system criteria includes membership status in the Siouxland Construction Alliance for architecture, general contractors, suppliers and specialty members, safety and lack of injury to employees on the job site, and the category degree of difficulty in the project and any special challenges or equipment requirements, the uniqueness of the design and the incorporation of new materials, innovation in materials, equipment and problem-solving techniques. So a lot of categories at which winners can be picked. And the project must also be substantially complete in 2020 to qualify and within 90 miles of the Sioux City offices. Photo submissions were required for nomination. So some just newly completed projects winning awards this year. Not too surprising. All some very, very fine construction projects.
Yes, they are.
We are 55 minutes into broadcasting.
Yes, so I think we must conclude today. A quick recap of the weather. Or Alan, is there anything else you want to give just a few seconds to?
It's It's cloudy, and we're going to see rain today, ending tonight, and sunny skies coming back in with warmer temperatures for the rest of the week ahead, at least through Thursday. Terry, what kind of almanac and birthdays are we looking at today?
All right. I'd like to share the birthdays for today, May the 30th, and those include Peter Carl Fabergé, the goldsmith and jeweler. He lived from 1846 to 1920. Mel Blanc, the voice actor, from 1908 to 1989. We would not have had Bugs Bunny.
Hey, what's up, Doc?
Without Mel Blanc. Benny Goodman, the band leader, lived from 1909 to 1986. Joseph Stein, the playwright, from 1912 to 2010. Gail Sayers, the football player, 1943 to 2020. Winona Judd, singer-songwriter. She was born in 1964. And Tom Morello also was born in 64, singer-songwriter and musician. Billy Donovan was born in 65, the basketball coach. Idina Menzel was born in 1971, singer-actress. Manny Ramirez was born in 72. CeeLo Green, born in 74. And Clint Bowyer, the race car driver and sportscaster, was born in 1979. So happy birthday to those celebrities and to anyone whose birthday is today, May the 30th. And we hope that our listeners have a wonderful holiday weekend on this Memorial Day holiday. Take care. Stay well.
Have a great weekend, and thank you very much for listening. We want to thank the Journal for the newspaper and thank Western Iowa Tech for helping with the broadcast, even though we're broadcasting from home these days. And We hope to get back in the studio, so Des Moines and the Iris people tell us, but we'll see what comes of that. But in the meantime, just keep listening to Iris, and take care. Bye-bye.